Welcome to Headset, the podcast that examines the unique mental skill sets of elite athletes, performers, and executives. It is our goal to discover the various skill sets that these individuals use to get their head set to perform. Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning into the Headset Podcast. This is Jason Galea, your host, and I am really excited to bring to you an incredible person and a real amazing interview with an incredible athlete, a guy who played in the NHL for 11 seasons, had close to 340 games under his belt, where he won 141 of those games, and he's an incredible human being, even more so than an athlete. His life story is one that will not only blow your mind, but it'll grab your heart. As an athlete, he's the only Bo Jackson-like athlete from the National Hockey League, and I won't ruin too much of his story and steal his thunder. But the guy that we're bringing you today, Mr. Clint Malarchuk, is an incredible human being and an incredible interview. If you get a chance, check out his numerous TED Talks and presentations on YouTube. He's an incredible speaker. But you can also find some incredible literature that he helped craft together. Clint has written two books, The Crazy Game and A Matter of Inches. Incredible books about not only sport, what sport does to you physically, mentally, emotionally, and what he's gotten out of this game and how this game has taken his life into so many different directions, both good and bad, is an absolute incredible, incredible journey. How his life has not been transcribed and turned into a movie, I have no idea. You won't believe half of what you're going to hear or half of what you would read unless you met the guy and saw that it's all true. I can't tell you what an incredible human being Clint is, but what he's doing now to help people in our society that are dealing with mental illness is incredible. He's a true humanitarian and a true amazing spirit of the heart, and I'm also really excited to do this interview with you because in this interview we have my partner from Headset Sports, Dr. Peter Papadijanis, involved as well. So to get three hockey goalies together in one spot talking about the game, sports, life, mental health, and helping others, I could have spoken on all these topics for another 3 days in a row. So I really hope that you enjoy this interview and all that we have to share with it. And I hope you and your family are doing well during these times. Okay, everybody. We've got a hot, hot commodity on the horn with us today. In my opinion, this guy is the first Bo Jackson of hockey. We got a guy who's synonymous for a incredible comeback story from a devastating, could have been life-ending career injury, but he also had a silent career as a second professional athlete that is quite astonishing. And when we get talking to Mr. Clint Malarchuk, we're going to throw him under the bus here and maybe even drag him by one of the horses that he used to ride as a rodeo star. So I want to thank back to our podcast here, Mr. Clint Malarchuk, for showing on up, and my partner in crime, Mr. Peter Papadijanis. We've got three goalies chewing the fat today. I'm sure there's a lot of crazy that's going to come on out. But guys, thank you again for getting together. It's great to have you on the pod and to be chewing the fat. And one of the things that we're talking about just before we start recording here is we talked about how each and every one of us are incurring more and more pressure with young athletes. And Clint, we know that you've recently done some talks with
kids in an academy down south in New Jersey, and we're hoping to pick your brain on that. But I got to ask you, when you were playing in the NHL, were you also doing cowboy stuff at the same time?
Yeah, that was kind of my summer activity. I'd get back out west in Alberta and spend my off season, and just kind of started rodeoing a little bit, and it got, you know, more and more every year. And I was able to kind of get through and work it into my, you know, my working out and everything else.
So, like, is that something that you got into as a kid? Did your parents take your horseback riding?
No, I was, we had a family. There was a ranch that was owned by a cousin. They had dairy, they had beef, they had sheep. It was a big full-blown working ranch. And I was basically a hired hand there. Probably from 12 years old, I'd help milk cows, you know, at 5 a.m. and all the rest of it. And I just grew up around that. That's where I learned the rodeo was from my cousins. They weren't blood cousins, but I guess second cousins or something like that. But yeah, that's who taught me. They were older. They're quite a bit older. They're probably in their 30s, and I was, you know, I was just a kid.
So when you're doing something like that, you're predominantly horse cowboy, correct? You were riding the buck and broncos, literally.
Right. My two events were saddle bronc and bareback bronc. And, wow. Later on, I got into team roping because it's just safer. My body was getting too beat up. So team roping was a little bit easier. Mm.
So I gotta ask you, buddy, how old were you when you got on one of those horses?
Oh, shoot. Probably I started riding when I was, you know, probably about 8 or 9.
Oh my God.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I wasn't on Bronx then though. I mean, I was riding, herding cows, vaccinating, you know, doing cowboy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it a nice getaway from hockey?
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. It was awesome. Yeah. You know, it's an individual sport. So the only pressure on you is the pressure you put on yourself. Right. And, you know, you don't have to, like, being a goalie, we all know we can win or lose a game and be the hero or the goat real quick. So there's more pressure in a team sport, especially when in a position like goalie or quarterback or pitchers.
Yeah. Sure.
Hey, can I ask, was there any transferring of the mental skills from net to riding and then riding to net?
Yeah, you know, visualization before you get on a bronc. I mean, well before you got on a bronc. You'd start visualizing, and a lot of times you don't know which horse you get. You start to have a little book on what certain horses will do. And so when you get a certain draw, they call it. So I draw this one horse, and I already have a little bit of a background on what that horse likes to do when he comes out of the chute. Does he turn left? Does he turn right? Does he take off straight ahead in a bolt and then start bucking? So yeah, you kind of get a book. So then you mentally visualize which horse, you know, riding that horse, the horse that you draw.
Hey, would you do that for back to goaltending?
Yes.
Visualize for just games, the guys that you played against.
Yes. Oh yeah, you always got a book on not just the opposing team and what they like to do as in offensive situations or power play. You know, we always studied the video, how we're going to penalty kill, what plays they like. Do they like to drop the puck low and then fire it across crease, or, you know, are they trying to hit it, you know, Ovechkin over on the right side, or left side rather. And you know, things like that. So yeah, but you also visualized for what you want to do against. So you had your team visualization, you know, the opposition, and then you had the individual players, what they like to do. We'd even study shootouts, what guys would do in shootouts, who were the top guys the team used. And, you know, I know when I was coaching, that was one of my responsibilities, was to have the goalies, I'd put it on an iPad, and the goalies before the game could look at, you know, their top five guys, let's say, that they use in shootouts and what they do.
Right. And you were ahead of, as Jay was mentioning, ahead of your time. Even that visualization piece from years back wasn't as kind of predominant as it is now for athletes to do.
No,
but you were doing it way back when.
I remember when I was coaching, I asked, and let's see, I retired as a player, I think it was 95, and I went right into coaching. And so I'd ask guys, one time I asked them, I said, who here does visualization or kind of knows what, you know, do you have a formal way of doing it or anything? And I would say, I was astonished. I can't remember how many hands, you know, were that did it and didn't do it. But I was astonished at the numbers. And I said, so they asked me, what do you mean? And I said, well, it's kind of like going to the movies. You know, you see it in your head and you just play tape and you see yourself doing things. Like for me would be as a goalie, I'd be making saves. If a guy liked to go high glove, an opponent, we're getting ready to play, I'd visualize myself making a glove save on that player.
So what you're saying, buddy, is that you were astonished how few
Yes.
guys were doing it? Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was, you know, the late 90s.
Holy you know?
So it wasn't all that long ago.
That's So now you see, if you ask that question now, you'll have maybe more of the room that do it. But when you talk to young and old athletes,
well, I think
really how to do it, they still don't really have a grasp of what they do it. But I don't know if people really know how to do it.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think we've probably grown in that area with the sports psychologists, you know, being more popular with teams, especially the professional teams. So that I think we've come a long ways, but yeah, I don't know if a lot of guys really have a formal way of doing it. And I had a very formal, organized, scheduled type way of doing my visualization, because I read a book on sports psyching, it was called, and had a 6-week kind of gradual week-to-week progress that you would do. And then you could implement it also like into your games between whistles when you might do visualization scene.
Wow.
Yeah. Hey, can you just elaborate on just the impact as you started to bring it into goaltending and also riding, like what the impact was as an athlete when you started to bring in those sports psychology concepts?
Well, when I was playing, you know, my first year as a pro, I was playing mostly in the American League. And if I did get called up to the NHL at the time, it was the Quebec Nordiques, I was lighting it up in the American League. I mean, we had a really bad team. I was seeing tons of shots. I was kind of like the bright spot. And I got a lot of work and a lot of practice in games because we didn't have very good teams. But when I got called up to the NHL, I'd be like, I don't think I performed as well as I did when I was in the American League, because – I would just be overwhelmed by, you know, the bright lights and TV and big stadiums, crowds, media. And so I think it affected me in my play negatively. So I ran across that book and I did the exercises and continued to do the daily exercises that they gave you for your, it's like lifting weights with your brain, really. And that's when I was able to make the transition from the and I always felt that book was kind of my secret weapon, and I was hoping other guys didn't get a hold of it, because I felt like I had an edge on them, you know, because I was doing this weight training with my brain.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. You know, it's interesting when you bring up the difference from the American League, then you jump up to the NHL, how it was different for you. Like, what do you mean by that? When you went from
the pressures were much greater at the NHL level. Like I said, you know, you're going from the American League, which is, you know, AAA and the next best league in the world, but that being maybe the KHL, the American League, and then you got the NHL, and so the NHL, I mean, you got the bright, like I said, bright lights, stadium, media, you know, 18,000 people instead of, you know, 3,000 to 6,000, and, you know, TV cameras and interviews, and, you know, just it's like you can feel the tension, you can feel the pressure. You know, games are being covered by the media and every facet of media. And at the American League or the minor league levels, it wasn't that intense at all, not even close. So there's the pressure. It's just the pressure. I mean, physically, I really believe physically there's a lot of goalies on the same par. And I believe I was in that category. There was a lot of goalies that were just like me, maybe skill-wise, you know, even physical size and that. And I think the difference between for me, anyways, playing in the minors and playing in the NHL was developing my mental skills. And, you know, I worked hard at it and I continued to work at it my whole career. So I felt I had a bit of an edge on guys because it was like, well, yeah, we might be working out, but I work out another 20 minutes a day doing my mental exercises.
And I'm glad you brought that up. It's just putting in a little bit of time. That seemed like it had great benefit by just doing it consistently and just right. Having it as part of your routine, just your recipe, right? So it's recipe for being successful.
Even at the NHL level, you got guys that, you know, are ahead of other guys only because of the mental toughness. And when I say toughness, I don't just mean not letting things bother you. Mental toughness is also the discipline to do the mental work that I did. And those are the guys that are going to, you know, surpass the guys that are just showing up at the rink and, you know, maybe they don't think they need to visualize or whatever. But I think it's more the common, more the norm now that guys do have a program because of the sports psychology that we've developed over the last 20 years or more.
Yeah, I agree in regards to just that work that's put in. It's just different type of work and you don't see it, right? You know, those are the parts you don't, no one saw you read the book. No one was seeing you in regards to just the media and fans, but you knew you were doing the work, right? That extra work that maybe someone else wasn't doing to give you that edge. Right. And that's awesome to hear because people don't know how hard high level athletes work at this stuff.
Yeah.
That's very true. Very true.
You know, Clint, I'm curious to know because I'm still so fascinated in what you had said that immediately when you were done playing, you jumped into coaching and how it was shocking that there were guys you were working with that really didn't do this and may not have even had a clue to do this. When you started working with these guys, did you ever talk about things going bad and how to come back from that?
Absolutely. That's part of visualization. There's times I visualize, you know, letting in a bad goal. And this is part of my practice, you know, and you feel the pressure and the crowd and all the negative emotion and how then you've built up some tools, how you, one of them was you tense your body everywhere and then you just release and then you do some deep breaths and then you can mentally rehearse making that goal a save.
Oh, I love it.
And that way you kind of, if it's in the middle of the game, you can even do it before the next face-off. Do it real quick and just visualize you're making the save. Nice. And then you can kind of put it on the shelf and revisit it at the end of the game, rather letting it bother and eat at you, maybe having a bad game because of it.
You know,
that's awesome that you said that because a lot of young athletes are just trying to figure out when do I do it? Like you just mentioned, and I think it's going to be awesome for the young athletes to hear this of when to do it. Like it's important to do it, but when do I do it? So finding the right time during a game, it could be a face-off. It could be maybe I had to just wait till the intermission to do it, but finding the right time. I love that you said that. That was awesome.
That's why the practice of doing it every day, even on off days, you know, take that 20 minutes. I just think you learn to do it when you have a formal structure guided maybe by a book or a psychologist, even better, a team psychologist, sports psychologist that can, you know, give you those tips and that guidance.
Yeah. And that's what Jay and I, when we created Headset, that was a big part of things that you're going to be on the bus, but you're going to be on a flight, you're going to have time at home. So just take a few minutes every day just to just keep it consistent. And it's a structured way, like just
right.
having an online program, a book, a person, just keeping that skill. It's like sharpened, right? Like I sharpen that tool to get it ready for the next time that I'm going to use it.
Well, in the book that I used, it was one of the first books. I mean, it was the only book I could find on sports psyching back then. And what I liked about it, you know, you started off with the physical part, doing physical relaxation, muscle tension, stuff like that. Then into the breathing, then the visualization, you know, all those things. But yeah, I think to do it in a structured way, that way you do learn how to do it a quick one right after a goal scored on you. You can do it a couple tense your body a little bit, release a couple mm-hmm. deep breaths, mentally rehearse the goal as a save, and then it's face off and you
yeah.
like you said, you can go forward.
And I'll be honest with you both, that's something that I didn't have when I was playing net, just that routine after being scored on. And it was just it was a free-for-all. There was no real plan there afterwards. And that's so important, as you're saying, like just being able to get ready quicker.
Yeah.
With that plan.
Yeah. For me, the worst is looking in the crowd. The worst is looking in the crowd. Like there were times I honestly felt that I didn't know what the hell I should be looking for when I looked in the crowd, because I sure as shit, I didn't want to look at the bench.
And then your coach might be yelling at you. He's saying, get ready, and you don't know what's going on. It's just, it becomes, and I think Clint, you were mentioning it, the bright lights, it can go sideways quickly. And when you don't have a plan, it can really get away from you.
Yeah, the ability to look up in the crowd and see people you know and see their faces kind of hung over, or their faces in a sense of, oh no, or their faces of, you know, here we go again, whatever it meant. Or whatever they were trying to handle themselves. For me, I found that was carrying over a good 3 to 5 seconds into the next shift, the next play.
Not good.
And not good. And I'm trying to erase the faces I just saw in my head. And now there's, you know, a howitzer coming at me.
Yeah. And you're not mentally ready.
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, you also go through – little things. This, at least, this is what was going on in my head. I could envision in my head the things that the guys were saying on the bench.
Yes.
Assuming. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We're all like, yeah. Yeah.
You know, right? Like, because you know, when it's not your turn to play or whatever, and you're on the bench and you're sitting with the boys, you pick up their phrases, you pick up their sayings, you pick up the things that they look at and critique, right? And now one's beat you. And at that moment, you're almost feeling like, I'd give anything to be back on the bench at this second right now, just to at least confirm what I'm thinking they're saying about me at this moment. Yeah. Right. And it's like, you just know it. And this weight on your back, that feeling of, oh God. Right. I can imagine what they're saying and thinking right now. But, you know,
also if the fans start getting in on heckling or anything, you know, it's even worse.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that always amazes me about the game is just the vernacular, the verbiage that we use in hockey with goalies. You know, it's a 2-on-1, meaning there's two forwards coming down the ice against one defenseman. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, I'm there too, dude. Right? How's that not a 2-on-2? Right? Or it's you even look at a power play, right? You look at a power play. It's 5-on-4, dude. We're in the net as well, dude. Like, no, like, isn't it a 5-on-5? Right? And as a kid growing up, hearing those terms, and I don't know what it was like for you guys, but every now and then, I had a coach at Pee Wee and a coach at you know, younger levels. They wouldn't even acknowledge the existence of us, right? In the cage. Again, you were just there. And then you hear the words, how did that beat you? You let that in.
Yeah.
You got scored on. You got scored on. Like the fact that the guy walked through all five guys on the ice and then shot the puck, right? Like you got scored on.
Well, goaltending is an island, and I think through the, you know, just the evolution of the game, it's always been that way. That verbiage has always been that way. So it's kind of like I use an example when I'm talking about, you know, self-esteem and mental health and mental toughness in just society. And you grow up with a parent that if you're crying because your feelings are hurt, they'll raise their hand and say, I'll give you something to cry about.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
So in other words, physically, if he hit you, now you can cry, but don't cry because your feelings are hurt.
Right. Right.
Oh, yes.
It's just the messages, you know, over the years in society and, of course, in sports.
It's scary. It's so scary. Yeah.
And you take those, as you're saying, guys, you take them with you, right? So that's that self-talk, right? You take it with you from game to game, but season to season, and it's there, right? It's part of you as an athlete that you have to try to, one, acknowledge, right? Clint, I think you've done all the times we talk, it's just the acknowledgement, right? I think that as a player, coach, friend, right? It's just being able to acknowledge that, yeah, there are challenges in sport and life. And then what are we going to do about it?
Right.
Right. That's why I've always heard from you as that acknowledgement piece that makes such a huge influence on that person feeling it. But it's that what are we going to do next? Right. That support and let's cope in moving forward, which I love every time talking to you about that.
Well, it's all part of the makeup of being a goaltender. I mean, there's no denying you have to be the most mentally tough and most mentally disciplined person on the team because of the pressure. And the pressure is that in that position, you have the ability more than any other player to win the game or lose the game for your team.
Yeah.
So how is it that you introduce, you know, mental skills to a young guy that you're working with that you look at and go, I can't believe this guy doesn't have anything.
I always recommended the book. I'd say order this book if you're serious about getting better. You got to develop your mind for the sport and for the position and get the book. But more importantly, it even says in the book, reading this book will help you, but it'll be short-lived. If you do the exercises, you're going to develop yourself, you know, just as you would build muscle lifting weights.
Yeah, I love that. I love that mental muscle. That's what Peter and I talk about all the time, the mental muscle between your ears. It's interesting, guys. On YouTube now, you can see a couple of really good visualization routines that are done by a couple athletes. One is Mike Camilleri, and the other one is with Braden Holtby, the goalie for the Washington Capitals. Just seeing what the routine is. And you know, one of the things that I realized a long time ago is that when I found just different ways to do breathing, I can't believe how much energy it saved for me, because I was so scrambled for so long hoping that something would fall into place for me. And when it didn't, it just felt like I was spent. And I had someone tell me way into my career that I was spending the same amount of energy dealing with my nerves that was equivalent to if I had already played two games before the game I was scheduled to play.
Yeah, mentally exhausted.
Just and even emotionally, like if I knew family was coming, if I knew family was showing up, and it was going to be one of those weekends where, you know, a little bit of pressure. Oh my God. Like the amount of energy I spent, I was a basket case for days, which is the thought that, oh my God, I got to keep it together. I can't lose this for everybody else. Like I didn't want to be the deciding factor for the win or the loss show.
You know, well, in the 80s, when the Oilers were winning their cups and they had just the powerhouse, you know, such a high octane offensive team. So I'd be, you know, with an Eastern team like Buffalo, Quebec, or Washington, and we go out on a road trip out to Alberta, and we're playing the Oilers. Well, first of all, playing the Oilers back then, if you were the starting goalie, you just hoped that you finished the game.
I love it.
And, you know, so right away there's that pressure. And then of course it's in front of all my friends and family too. So going into Edmonton and even Calgary back then was, I mean, it was, and that's my family. That's where I'm from. So I could totally relate to the other pressures that we are, our mental self-talk, you know, that we're not even aware sometimes that we're doing.
It makes you wonder when you're an athlete dealing with this kind of stuff, it makes you wonder if it's actually easier to play on the road.
Yeah. Yeah. I love playing on the road. I don't know. I was away from distractions. You didn't have that home crowd pressure for sure. You were kind of like the underdog, you know, going into another building, and some of them could be pretty hostile environments. And so, yeah, I mean, it's there's a variety of ways we could go. And if we ever looked at our self-talk or stopped, went, what am I saying to myself here? You know, why am I feeling anxious? Well, because I'm feeling anxious because I might get pumped for six, seven, eight goals playing against the Oilers, you know?
Yes. It's so, and it's pretty brutal when you think about the fact that you feel that way because you're worried about the mistakes you're going to make.
Right.
It's not like I could go out there and stand on my head and win this game and everything would be great. It's the opposite. I could go out there and I could lose everything. It's going to be brutal, right? I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to be the one that's going to be.
That's why we have to train ourselves.
Yeah.
To not go down that road mentally and to be in the positive, confident building, self-talk and visualization. That's huge. Yeah. You know, you see yourself in your head making saves all the time. Well, it's going to build your confidence.
Yeah, it's built, right? I love that you guys are saying that. It's almost, and I use it in practice, like a house, like it's built brick by brick.
Yeah.
Right? And some of those bricks are going to fall down, but you have to stay on it to keep on building that foundation because it's going to test you. That's competition, right? We love that part.
There's a guy named Lloyd Percival, a basketball guy, I think, and the story goes, and I think it's in that book as an example too. They did. I think it was half the team did practice free throws and the other for like 2 weeks. And then the other team, the other half of the team just did mental rehearsal of practicing free throws. And then they did a test before the 2 weeks and then a test after. And the improvement was in the ones that did it just on the mental. So that's how powerful it is visualization.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
yeah.
So
all they did for 2 weeks is practice making baskets, you know, in their head. And they had a bit higher movement rate than ones that were practicing it physically and not doing anything mentally.
Yeah. And now we have that support through the research, right? We have brain scans now and research that we can say that it actually works, right? It's not hokey. It's actually back base, which is so different from coming back to when you play Clint, right? Like this was all new back in that day and you were doing it, right? Where now we've kind of researched those parts and saying, yet you, that's important that you do this.
Well, it is. And like you say, now we have surveys and exercises that they've done, like the one, my example with the basketball, that have proven it.
Yeah, and not to get off topic, there's a guy that has done brain scans of people who are in a vegetative state, who when he asks them a yes answer, he just asks them to, he just tells them, imagine playing tennis. And the person can't respond physically, but they know that person is functioning cognitively when they can just imagine playing tennis. Because the same part of your brain that when you actually play tennis, it lights up.
Yeah.
Which is really, really cool that we can test this stuff now.
Yeah, for sure. Oh. Wasn't like that when I played.
Oh, for sure.
No.
Hey, can we transition? We were talking about the book, but also the work that you're doing with your book and also some videos online about, I just know I always come back to your TED Talk, which I love, but can you talk a little bit about just your work now that you're doing with athletes and non-athletes?
Emotional sickness, where life just is not going real good for somebody, and they're really struggling with anxiety or depression, but it doesn't mean they're mentally ill. So for me to get out there and speak to, tell my story, make other people realize that they are not alone, that, you know, like so many of us have struggled or struggle still.
Yeah, it's true.
Once people realize too that, you know, with mental illness for me, I have a chemical imbalance where I don't produce enough serotonin with my brain. And, you know, what's the difference if it's a diabetic? It's a chemical imbalance as well. But with mental illness, it's perceived as a weakness rather than an illness or a sickness.
So true. Yeah. So true.
And something that is treatable, right? So just like any other challenge that you go through.
It's treatable. But the thing is, people think it's a weakness and they stay in the darkness. They don't want to step out and let people, the shame and guilt and being judged. And that's the stigma of mental illness that we still have. We're a lot better in society now, but we still got a long ways to go. You know, just with that, those things are still, the perception is still out there that it's a weakness. And once people can get past that, especially men, you know, they don't want to step out and say, yeah, I struggle with depression or anxiety or any of these things because of the stigma.
You know what I noticed too? It's funny you mentioned that, Clint, because I noticed that men are exceptionally guilty for self-medicating. You know, you get to a point where you can get some help and you realize that it's a chemical imbalance, and then things get good. You know, you buy in. And things get good, and you're back to a stable and progressive lifestyle. And then all of a sudden you forget and you say, you know what? I don't need the purple pill anymore. I don't need it anymore. I'm better now. Right. Rather than looking at it, like you said, which is a fantastic comparison with being a diabetic. You know, a diabetic that doesn't complain about this.
There's no shame and guilt being a diabetic, is there?
None. Absolutely none. Absolutely none. And it's like you said, it's funny and it's sad and it's almost painful to see how so many people still have a hard time just accepting that it's, you know, something that's going on with your body. It's not a flaw in you.
Especially in sports where physical pieces are that much more magnified. Right, and maybe even the social media part now, and the media, traditional media. There's just a lot of those kind of added pressures that it's equally, if not tougher, for some of these athletes to be able to talk about it, which they should, as you both are saying. Like that's part of the medical.
I use the military as an example a lot of times. You know, you talk about mentally tough to do that job. We're talking life and death, and you know that's mental toughness. Yep, our military, they go over there just if Afghanistan and Iraq veterans, we've had 22 suicides a day with those veterans. I think it's down now, I heard, was down to 19, which is great, but still that's these are the most mentally tough people in the world. They go over there and get damaged mentally, and we call it PTSD now. And they come back and self-medicate and die by suicide. It's a shame. But were they mentally weak? No. They proved that by going to war. They were mentally strong.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, well said. I'm even thinking about, like, EMTs, like ambulance drivers, other kind of safety jobs where they're in it all day, every day in regards to just pressures and things that they see and feel. And would you say they're weak? Probably the exact opposite.
For sure, that's the exact opposite. And you know, I look at our you know, the accumulative trauma that they see. You know, one accident after another, one death after another, this and that, and they don't ever process. They go home. Hey, honey, how was your day? Oh, great. You know.
Yeah.
Because I'm tough and I'm a first responder, I'm a fireman, I'm tough, I'm a cop, you know, the high testosterone jobs.
It's so true. What you say, like, you know, when you think about it, right, the position we played, and the titles of first responder, whether it's a police officer or it's a fire person, you don't get called upon unless something bad happened, right? Think of the 911 operator. No one's ever calling the 911 operator to say, how's your day going, right? Just thought I'd give you a call and see how things are going, right? Hope all is well, right? It's not that. The only reason your phone rings or you get the call is because something bad happened, right?
Yeah, I spoke at a conference for dispatch operators, and I didn't think of that as them having PTSD or trauma, but they are taking these calls, like you mentioned, but they get no closure. Once the first responders arrive on scene, they're done. They're off the phone and on to another call. So on to another traumatic call, probably, or somebody in panic and maybe has a loved one in distress.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine what those poor people go through when it's a child that might be calling. I don't even know.
I was doing some work with first responders, mostly fire. And they went out on a call, they came back to the fire hall, and I said, okay, let's sit down and talk about that. Like, did it affect anybody? Oh, it was just a little fender bender, no big deal. But then one guy picked up from our meeting before they went on the alarm call, and he said, you know what, guys, remember a month ago I had to pull that kid out of the car? And he goes, you know, that kid has the same t-shirt as my kid, and he's the same age. And he said, that really, really affected me. And I he told no one.
Oh, my God.
And so months later, and he's opening up. So I said, okay, now, and then another guy spoke up and said, well, that one didn't bother me because I don't have kids. But this other one, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, we got these men processing their trauma just by talking about it and saying, yeah, it bothered me. It caused me a lot of anxiety or depression or whatever. And so it's peer support, obviously, but it's processing their trauma. So what I encourage them to do is after each call, just when you get back to the fire hall, do a check-in with each other. Just say, hey, that trigger anybody? Let's get it out on the table right now. Let's get rid of it.
Oh, that's the space they have, right? You created with them a space for them. It's just part of the routine. Why don't we, like, well, put it on the table? Then
And I also went into the fact that, you know what, in those type of jobs, military, first responders, they're parts of teams. They're part of a team. And everybody in there is your teammate. So when you're running into a burning building, you better trust your teammate that he's doing what he's supposed to do and you're doing what you're supposed to do. So why can't you process and be vocal about these issues and your calls that you go on? Use your teammates.
I like that you mentioned that it has that team sport. It can translate into these high-stress jobs where we're all counting on each other. We want everyone to be at the top of their game, helping each other, and this is just a way for us to be connected as we work on our jobs. I love that. That's awesome.
It's amazing. It's amazing because, you know, that debrief that you did with them, Clint, is so huge. You know, in my limited work that I've done with military people and teams, one of the big terms that they use, acronyms they use, is SOPs. And SOP stands for Standard Operating Procedure. And what they've embedded into their program at the higher levels, like I can speak firsthand with Navy SEALs. In terms of SOP, we think of it as just something that we're going to use as a planning strategy of how we're going to go in and get out. But SOPs goes even further than that. It goes into what you did with those first responders. It's sitting back afterwards and going through the standard operating procedure of debriefing and saying what worked and what didn't work. And
exactly.
What do you guys feel about that? You know, what do you feel about how we did what we did? Are you buying in or are you just holding on? Right?
Right.
Are you part of the energy moving forward or, you know, are you a pylon on the side of the road just watching it all happen? And it's such a huge piece.
I call it being in balance, you know, mental health and you know, your physical, all that mental well-being, let's just say. But, you know, if one of your teammates is like you're kind of describing, out of balance because he's not bringing this out, it's going to hurt the team. It's going to hurt him too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's bound to happen. It's bound to happen to every team member, right? If we talk about like sport, the season or work year is so long. There's so many things that go on. How is it not going to happen to every person?
Right.
Exactly. And it does. People go through, they're not mentally ill, but they go through, I call them emotional sickness, just because it's getting to them. Life is getting to them. The job, the boss, maybe, the kids, the sports, and getting here, you know, and, you know, oh, I got to work overtime. All these things, life stressors.
Oh.
Yeah. You have this one part clip. I think it's the TED Talk where it's right at the end. I remember you almost have like a recipe for yourself.
Oh yeah,
five different points. I love that. Like it, you end, and again, it's just one of your talks, but it's the one that kind of sticks with me. Like kind of showing people that there's a recipe. Like everyone has a recipe.
Well,
you just mentioned a little bit about if you remember that one TED Talk, the recipe.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's everyone has a recipe. We want everyone to have a recipe. And I think that's why some people founder, because they don't have a recipe. And for me, you know, I got kind of a checklist that I try to do daily. Well, three or four of these things I can do daily. Meditation, I learned the mindfulness part of, you know, being in the now. People spend way too much regretting the past and fearing the future. And that causes chaos and anxiety in a person. So meditation is a way that, you know, you got a safe place to go. You can need a 10-minute timeout once you, you know, and just get reconnected as part of your balance. So I've learned to meditate. Obviously, I take medication and you know, there was a time I didn't keep in check with my medication. I went 15 years just taking the same med, and over time, my body got immune to it. And, you know, I spiral downward. I try to work out every day, even if it's something short and sweet. So those are three things that I try to do daily. I could also, I try to read at least a little bit, you know, if I can find some time to read, you know, usually a book on getting better with life or whatever, self-help type book. But counseling is something I have to keep track of, you know. About a year ago, I fell into a slump with flashbacks of the skate coming up and cutting my jugular vein. And I was waking up and screaming in bed. So I went to a counselor who did EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And it's another thing that's been scientifically proven, some about the eyes moving left and right and triggering the brain left and right, and doing talk therapy helps you process whatever trauma, you know, obviously mine was the skate, but whatever trauma somebody might be going through. And then just the final thing for me is being a service. And I, you know, that doesn't always necessarily mean going and giving a speech or a talk somewhere. That definitely is what really keeps me happy and confident and going. But being a service, you know, I'm not always traveling doing that. So I talk, you know, we're being a service right now doing this podcast because somebody might hear it and go, oh my gosh, I relate to that. I'm going to do something. Being a service is something that, you know, I try not to give advice because I can say what happened, but what worked for me and what didn't work for me, but it might not work for them. So, but I give of self, I guess my point being, I try not to give advice, but I give of self and support.
You know,
that's kind of my recipe.
You know, it's interesting what you say with giving of yourself. It's amazing how much more and more and more I hear in so many different walks of life, in sport, in business, whatever it may be, about the giving of yourself, the giving of yourself. You know, I just heard a talk not so long ago about a gentleman who's an expert in leadership training, and he talks about being the servant leader, the giving of yourself to help others rise above, the giving of yourself to help others find success. And it's incredible, you know, and I don't know if that's something you get with age or you get with experience or it's all the above, but that giving of yourself, I can relate to it to the point where it gives me goosebumps hearing you talk, because all my life, just being able to help somebody else has meant more to me than finding a dollar on the floor. You know, I don't know what it is.
Sometimes people say, oh, you do so much. And, well, you know, thank you for those compliments. But a lot of it is, I do it for me, too, because it makes me feel good.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It really feels good helping somebody, you know. And I think so much of our life, we're so caught up with the hustle and the bustle and the performance of things. We don't take enough deep breaths to wonder how those around us are breathing. You know,
right.
You know, Clint, one of the things that you said in that talk, which I've passed on to at least five people, is you're saying, my mind is a bad neighborhood and I don't go there alone.
My mind's just like a bad neighborhood and I don't go there alone. Meaning basically if you keep it inside, you know, you're obviously talking about something that's bothering you or, you know, whatever, but if you keep it inside, it's just going to stay there. If you share it with somebody, you know, you cut it in half and, you know, plus you're probably helping them too, making them feel like they're not alone.
So true. So true. So true. Well, fellas, I got to say this. I can't thank you enough for putting the time aside for us to get together and to talk. I mean, not to sound like a cheesy relative, but I feel like we should be doing this more often together. And
we will. We're coming to your house.
No, oh, yeah.
All right. Door's always open. I haven't locked this house since I've owned it.
Oh, it's like 7-Eleven, right? No locks on the door.
No locks. I keep the keys are in the trucks. People, you know, just don't, where I live, it's just, like I said, I haven't locked this house up since I bought it.
You know what? I've had a couple of coaches refer to my goaltending the same way. Fellas, thank you for this. Thank you.
All right.
Bear with. Hold on.
All right. Talk to you guys.